Thanks and welcome to the program. Today a follow-up to last week's health report, which covered the extraordinary story of Tutankhamun through genetic detective work. It showed how his incestuous ancestors gave him diseases which made his short life a misery and almost certainly disfigured him and made him look nothing like the masks we see of the young pharaoh. It also gave names to other mummies, like Tutankhamun's real mummy. This week, the search for ancient infections like malaria, tuberculosis and leprosy using modern genetic fingerprinting. It's telling us a lot about how people might have lived and indeed how the environment's changed over thousands of years, often through man-made changes. And maybe it offers clues to how we might cope with these diseases in the future. Dr. Helen Donoghue works in the Medical Microbiology Department at University College London.
You first of all find a good sample where there's a good likelihood of excellent preservation. Everything depends on how the specimen's been preserved over time. Doesn't matter the chronological age, what's important is where it's been and what it's experienced. I work with DNA. DNA is rather a fragile molecule and it does tend to fragment with age. Generally, cold, no oxygen, constant conditions is good.
And how about the way the preservers preserved the bodies in ancient times? Did that make a difference?
Made it a lot more difficult to get the DNA out.
Really?
Yes, the paper which I've published recently was about Dr. Granville's Egyptian mummy. That was preserved in a unique way, the details of which are still obscure. We know it was unusual because the body of a middle-aged woman was mummified with most of her internal organs intact, and generally at that time they would have been removed.
So tell me about this mummy.
I can tell you a lot about the mummy. She was...
Who was Dr. Granville for a start?
Dr. Augustus Bozzi Granville. He was rather a rebellious Italian who was imprisoned while a medical student for campaigning for the unification of Italy. I think he had an English grandmother. He came to England, and next time I read about him, he was one of the physicians in ordinary to the Duke of Cumberland. He was obviously a very fashionable obstetrician.
And how did he come across the mummy?
He had an aristocratic patient. At that time, after Bonaparte's army went into Egypt, there was a craze for everything Egyptian. It affected...
This is the 19th century we're talking about here.
Early 19th century, but really we're talking about 1815, 16, 17. But Egyptian mania persisted after the fall of Napoleon. And it became an aristocratic practice to acquire Egyptian memorabilia, including if you were rich enough to buy a mummy. And it was even an after-dinner pastime of aristocratic gentlemen to have unwrappings.
And this mummy in particular?
Well, this mummy was offered to Dr. Granville, and Dr. Granville was a scientist at heart, I think, and he specialised in gynaecology, and he decided to do a proper scientific autopsy on this Egyptian mummy, originally at the home of the aristocrat, but was completed in the premises of the Royal Society.
And he came to a diagnosis?
Perhaps you find what you look for and you look for what you know about. He was a gynaecologist. He noticed an unusual growth on one of the ovaries of this lady and he believed it to be a form of cancer, and so he diagnosed her as having died of cancer.
How old was this mummy?
You mean the age of when it came from or the age of the individual at death?
Well, both.
Well, the woman was middle-aged, probably over 50, which was quite a good age for that time.
That was old age then.
It was indeed.
And how long ago did she live?
She lived about 600 BC.
And why did you go off and investigate this?
When molecular methods began to be applied to archaeological material, so we could amplify DNA, and it enables you to identify, in my case, particular species of bacteria. There was a group of people involved in this. There was the Department of Egyptology at the British Museum, and my collaborator, Dr. Mark Spiegelman, who's a visiting professor at UCL.
And Australian.
Indeed, he is Australian. I should have mentioned that. And, of course, Dr. Granville had done a destructive autopsy, and the only pieces that were left were a few bits of tissue that were in a rather nice mahogany box that was discovered in the basement of the British Museum. I found later that the British Museum had purchased the remains of the mummy in about 1860.
So what happened when you studied it?
Well, other people had looked microscopically at the tissue. They determined that the possible tumour on the ovary was actually a cyst, and it was benign and could not be the cause of death. Therefore, we had to look for another cause of death. And the histologists who were looking at the lung tissue...
Histologists are people who look down the microscope at tissue.
That's right. And they discovered the typical appearance of what we call an inflammatory exudate. That means somebody...
Pus.
Well, somebody had something like pneumonia. They had a very active, angry infection in their lungs, and that could have been the cause of death. And one of the diseases which can cause that right at the very end of life is tuberculosis. We have a middle-aged lady. Middle age or even old age is a time where if people have been harbouring the disease in a latent form over a lifetime, that can be when it re-emerges as natural immunity drops. And also, we know from other studies, there was a great deal of tuberculosis in ancient Egypt, especially in Thebes. And we know that that was a large ancient city. People were crowded together in close proximity to each other. And that meant that if they had a disease spread from infected lungs by aerosols, such as tuberculosis, it would spread very well. So we thought it was a good disease to start looking for.
And you came up trumps.
With a great deal of difficulty. And we were able to team up with collaborators based at Birmingham University in the UK who work on the very waxy cell walls of these bacteria. And they use a totally different method of looking for evidence of the organism. And so I eventually, with great difficulty, did manage to find some of the DNA. But it was backed up by this totally independent method of looking for evidence of the bacterial cell walls.
So the poor woman died of TB?
We reckon she did. Probably a reactivated TB. The people at Birmingham were able to directly measure the amount of the material from the bacteria in different organs and bones from the body. And they even found evidence of it in the femurs, the long bones of the leg. And that means it was a disseminated infection. It had spread around the body. And if that happens and you've got no treatment, then you'll die from it.
Helen Donoghue of University College London, a microbiologist, and I suppose you could also call her an archaeological geneticist. You're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National with me, Norman Swan. In addition to looking at mummies for TB, Helen Donoghue and her colleagues have a strong interest in leprosy, which is caused by another member of the bacterial family that TB belongs to. What they've been trying to find out is why leprosy died out in cooler climates such as Northern Europe.
Leprosy is caused by Mycobacterium leprae. It is a rather unusual organism. We now know the total sequence of its genome, and we realise that it has lost an awful lot of genetic material. It's lost so much it can't carry out an independent existence. It has to live inside another cell. It's a specific human infection. We can, with difficulty, infect armadillos. And there are some wild armadillos running around in the United States and Mexico that we think may have originally come from laboratory animals.
They're infected with leprosy.
They are. The organism will not survive unless it's inside a living cell.
And it affects humans how?
It has a great deal of stigma associated with it. You can have a very destructive, disfiguring type of presentation of the disease called lepromatous leprosy. We think it was this sort of leprosy that was so feared in ancient times. We believe that the French impressionist Gauguin, we think he had lepromatous leprosy. This is where you get destruction of tissue. The organism targets the Schwann cells that line nerves, and they end up damaging nerves. And the real pathology of leprosy is caused by destruction of nerves. So people lose sensation, so they have secondary damage to their hands, feet, any other sorts of injuries. They're not aware of being injured, and you can get gangrene, burns. The other extreme of leprosy is what we call tuberculoid leprosy, where the individual person has a very good host response.
And then, in other words, their immune system really gets onto it.
That's right. And you can hardly be aware that the person is ill. We've been doing some modern work in Central America looking at cases of tuberculoid leprosy, and we found a lot of it around, not recognised by the local doctors, and it looks like a little skin lesion. The only thing is, when you touch it with the end of a biro pen, the person can't feel you touch the lesion. The nerve's been destroyed. Then you ask them to put their hands down flat on a surface, and their little finger or their ring finger can't go down flat. That's because the bacteria are damaging the nerve, especially around the elbow. And if those aren't treated, they can go on to form a more destructive form.
Now, as you say, there was this terrible stigma. In fact, so much stigma, they changed the name of it. They called it Hansen's disease to hide the fact that it's leprosy people are talking about. But you have argued that the rise of tuberculosis caused a fall in leprosy, that there is some interrelationship between the two. But if that's true, and there was so much tuberculosis in ancient Egypt, why also was there so much leprosy?
I have to disagree with you, I'm afraid. The earliest case of leprosy of which we're aware that's been proved by DNA is in a paper that we published that was from the first century outside Jerusalem. That is the earliest known case where we've got molecular proof. There is paleopathological proof, that means bony changes consistent with leprosy, going back to about 400 or 500 BC.
So really, it's a more recent condition.
There's very limited evidence of leprosy in very ancient humans.
So it might have been a new disease round about the time of Christ.
Before then, I think a few hundred years before. There is a theory that it existed longer ago. If you believe there are some very early Sanskrit scrolls that referred to in ancient China, and I think we can just about get it back to about 1000 BC or perhaps 1200 BC. But let me just explain how we got to our theory. We were particularly interested in what happened in Europe. When we published our paper, one of our colleagues who works in India said, well, if that's the case, why is there still leprosy in India? I think there's an environmental reservoir, and we're beginning to get molecular evidence of an environmental reservoir. There's Japanese groups who found leprosy DNA in wells in the Philippines and Indonesia, and I've found it in soil samples from Nicaragua and Honduras.
And just to explain the importance of an environmental reservoir, is that with tuberculosis, one of the problems is that there are quite a few animals in which tuberculosis resides, as well as humans.
The interesting thing about tuberculosis is that there's a group of very closely related species known collectively as the Mycobacterium tuberculosis complex, or MTB complex. This includes Mycobacterium bovis and a cluster of very closely related species that infect other animals such as goats and deer and seals.
And bovis being the cow.
Yes, but they are all of a more recent lineage than the human one. And the other thing is that we now know how to differentiate different lineages of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and different human populations have co-evolved over time and they've got their own lineage. So if you look at somewhere like San Francisco or London or Montreal, where you've got a big multicultural population, you find people of different ethnic origins, and even though
they've got their own personal TB.
They have their lineage of TB that is most associated with people of their genetic and ethnic background. There are a few more recent strains which are beginning to spread around the world, which tend to infect people irrespective of where they're from. But there's ones associated with Pacific Oceanic areas, there's Indian, there's East Africa, West Africa. They have their own lineages, and you find the transmission seems to work better if it's going person to person of somebody with the same genetic background. So really, you can fingerprint people's strains of MTB that they're harbouring, because many people have a latent infection. You can have second or third generation San Franciscans who have their own particular strain of MTB.
So come back to your theory after that little diversion.
Sorry about that. Okay, it was triggered by our work on the Shroud Tomb in first century Jerusalem, which we published they had tombs where bodies were buried for about a year, and the normal practice was after a year, when decay had taken place, was to rebury the bones in an ossuary. And a lot of tomb robbers were around, and an archaeology team from the Hebrew University or Israel Antiquities Authority, they discovered a sealed locus, a little space in this tomb that had all been sealed up with plaster and hidden by boulders. And within that was an undisturbed little space in the tomb. And they had an individual there who apparently had been wrapped in a shroud. The body had almost totally decayed. There was just one little finger bone left, I think, and a few bits of hair and the shroud. Well, the shroud got a lot of publicity because it's very different from the Turin shroud. And so they said, oh, you know, this work showed the Turin shroud as a medieval fake. The thing about the bone was originally I had looked at all the material from that cave for tuberculosis. But Mark Spiegelman, my collaborator who got me into this years ago, he said there must have been a reason why they didn't want to go back to that person. Perhaps they were scared. Perhaps there was something obviously infectious. Why don't you look for leprosy? And I did look for leprosy, and I found evidence of M. leprae DNA in the bones from that individual, but nobody else in that tomb complex. So perhaps he was right. This individual had something visually scary. So there we had somebody who had tuberculosis and leprosy. Then I talked to my former head of department, John Stanford, and he has worked on both diseases for many, many years. He said that leprosy doesn't kill people, tuberculosis does. He lent me a copy of a little book written by Dr. Hansen, the famous Norwegian bacteriologist who was writing about leprosy in the late 19th century. He said the greatest cause of death amongst his leprosy patients in Oslo Hospital was tuberculosis. It was killing them all. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because if somebody has got leprosy and it's late stages, they are stigmatised, they may be outcast, they may be having to beg for food, they may have other diseases as a result of their infection, and they are not going to be in a position to be able to resist tuberculosis. Now, Norway was the last country in Western Europe to have a big leprosy problem. It was amongst the Norwegian fishermen. So Hansen's patients were probably the last large group of endemic leprosy patients. There still are a few, but not very many. So I started thinking about this and wondering whether this occurred at other times in history. So I started re-examining all my tuberculosis positive archaeological samples to see if there was any sign of leprosy. And I was also given some archaeological samples to look for leprosy, and I started looking in them for evidence of tuberculosis. And I found quite a large proportion that showed signs of co-infection. And now, obviously, this wasn't a randomised sample. People gave me samples to look at because there were pathological signs on the bones. So if I find tuberculosis in people who obviously had leprosy, it doesn't mean to say that was the real incidence. They were pre-selected. But I found quite a proportion of them to have tuberculosis. Now, there had been an earlier theory that there was cross-immunity between the diseases because they were both mycobacteria. If you were immune to one, you were immune to the other. There were all sorts of theories about the relationship between the organisms, but nobody had thought that tuberculosis might actually be more likely to infect somebody who was under the weather with a nasty disease like leprosy.
Or it could go the other way. It could facilitate the leprosy infection.
Yes, it may. But interestingly, there's a very limited immunological relationship between tuberculosis and leprosy. So nobody, as far as I'm aware, had actually suggested that either you have a resurrected latent TB infection or you're more likely to acquire and get ill with an external TB infection if you're a leprosy patient. But we suggested that. And that does fit in very nicely time-wise. If you look at what happened in Western Europe, specifically Western Europe, and I say that because Western Europe, I think it was cold enough that you've got no natural reservoir in the environment for M. leprae. M. leprae will not grow below about 30 degrees centigrade. In Western and Northern Europe, I think it needed a host in order to persist. I think the reason why you still find leprosy around the world nowadays is it's all within the equator and, you know, 30 degrees north or south. I think it depends on the ambient temperature.
And so the theory is what?
The theory is that people have leprosy, they're more likely to acquire or have reactivated tuberculosis, and the tuberculosis will kill them. And so they may have had leprosy, but the cause of death will go down as TB. And there was some rather nice studies done in French Polynesia. Polynesia seems to be one of the most recent parts of the world that was newly infected with leprosy. I think that's why Gauguin was unlucky in Tahiti.
And so you relate this to the decline of leprosy. How?
Leprosy is not readily acquired. You need prolonged intimate contact with somebody who has leprosy in order to get it. What we find is in the late Middle Ages in Western Europe, leprosaria, places where lepers were herded together and ostracised, they died out. In the end, lepers were being bought and sold, because if a monastery had people suffering from leprosy, they could get alms for them, and actually there were all sorts of...
They were a money-making source.
They were a money-making source. You needed some leprosy patients in order to keep going in some cases.
But they ran out. Leprosy declined.
That's right. And so there was a whole primitive social services based around looking after leprosy patients. And what happened was, as you got the move from the rural areas into cities, you get greater collections of people in towns more likely to have a disease like tuberculosis being maintained and spread. Then you find the incidence of leprosy really dropping off very, very quickly. And in fact, it's almost a mirror image. As leprosy went down, tuberculosis went up. What happened was, people who were ill with leprosy were more susceptible to TB. TB kills you quickly, and so they didn't...
So you lost the susceptible population.
Yeah, so they didn't have time to pass it on.
But essentially what you're saying is that the humans who could have been infected by leprosy died out incredibly quickly in the cities because they got TB.
That's it in a nutshell, yes. I don't think it happened in other parts of the world, because I think there was an environmental reservoir that kept the leprosy going. But in Western and Northern Europe, I believe there isn't. And I think that's why the disease died out.
People talk about TB, along with malaria, as the most ancient infections of humans. Was there ever a time when TB was new? You've got to what I think is the oldest case of TB ever found.
We did publish a paper back in 2001 where we found DNA evidence of tuberculosis in a Pleistocene bison, but the DNA was not well enough preserved for us to be sure exactly what lineage it was. If you look at tuberculosis in the world today, we reckon 1/3 of the world population is infected with the organism. Only 10% will show symptoms. We know it depends on natural immunity. It's particularly bad in parts of the world where there's a lot of immunodeficiency caused by HIV and AIDS. But if you've got a healthy individual, they're not taking immunosuppressive drugs, they're not getting organ transplants, they've got good nutrition, they're not suffering nutritional or social stress, they should by and large be resistant to TB. We're more susceptible very early in life because the immune system's still developing. We're more susceptible adolescents because of all the changes taking place with hormones. Mycobacteria, MTB, is very good at metabolising, breaking down hormones. Lots of hormones around, very good for the organisms. Pregnant women may be a bit more susceptible if they've got latent TB, because you get immunosuppression during pregnancy, although that's still not absolutely certain. And you get more susceptible in the absence of any intervention with antibiotics in middle to late age, because your natural immunity gets less efficient, and with increasing age you get more liable to get reactivation of your original latent infection, or you can acquire it externally. Now we can fingerprint the DNA, we can find that both these processes go on. You can actually have a recurrent MTB infection with the same strain of TB you were infected with at the start of your life in your 80s.
And its origins in time.
The origins? Well, we have to go back a very long time, I think. If you look at the estimates of how long it has taken for the MTB to evolve, when you have that level of latency, if you think 90% of people infected will be have latent infection, that indicates a very, very long period of coexistence. So we think certainly...
The fact that your body can cope with it.
Exactly. We've learned to live with each other. And so really we're going back before the discovery of agriculture and farming. We're going back to the hunter-gatherer stage. There are even people who think that there's a skull that was found in Turkey of Homo erectus, and they believe that that skeleton shows signs of tuberculosis.
Do primates get it? Non-human primates?
Yes, they can. It's very unusual for other animals to actually get the human lineage. What we do know is that in the Rift Valley in East Africa, there are the most ancestral forms of this group of bacteria that we know. There are different species called Mycobacterium kinetti. They are much more varied than the organisms found in the MTB complex. We describe all the forms of tuberculosis that infect humans and modern-day animals as having gone through an evolutionary bottleneck. The Mycobacterium kinetti strains, which can rarely cause a form of tuberculosis, these have not gone through a bottleneck. There's more variety in them than there is between all the different species in the MTB complex. They are still found today in the Rift Valley in East Africa, and we think that is where both humans and the MTB complex originated.
And the bottleneck was what?
The bottleneck, I believe, would have been tolerating growth within human cells. One reason why the organism is so difficult to eliminate by our immune system is the bacteria are very good at surviving and actually growing inside our own cells. Now, that would have been quite a big jump.
Has anybody ever been infected with an ancient organism by studying it?
No, we did actually, with our collaborators in Jerusalem, we did try to see whether the main experimental animal to use for tuberculosis work is a guinea pig. They're very sensitive. And no, the guinea pigs all carried on running around their cages very happily. We weren't surprised, because if you look at ancient DNA, it fragments. It's not an intact organism.
Does this ancient work inform new treatments or vaccines? Does it give us information that helps?
Not directly. There's a great deal of interest in it, because we can recognise by all this early work that the amount of change taking place in the last 150 years is an exponential increase in the rate. It's just rocketed.
So you mean this is the genetic change in the
yes.
organism? Why is
so
that?
The organism has changed more in the last 150 or 200 years. It's probably changed over the last 2 million years.
Do we know why?
Because of antibiotics. The other thing is, there's been a similar increase in the total global human population. So you have a huge number of extra potential people who can be infected, and you have very stringent conditions imposed on the organism that are pushing it to change in a certain way so it can evade modern day drugs. I'm really interested in understanding the relationship of these bacteria and ourselves. It's looking at the relationship between a pathogenic bacterium and ourselves. That's what's important. And I think we've borrowed from modern day diagnostics, and the modern day work I'm doing in Central America has been informed by the methods I've developed to work on the ancient leprosy. So they do benefit each other.
But in essence then, in an era where we've confronted new and emerging diseases, Ebola, HIV and others, although those are viruses, just reminds us that disease is not just an organism, it's how we interact with it and how we interact with the environment.
Indeed. But as far as the ancient DNA work, I find it fantastic fun and really exciting, and it's a little bit like molecular Indiana Jones. You have to understand the past in order to have a hope of understanding the future.
Microbiologist and geneticist Helen Donoghue from University College London. You've been listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. I'm off to America to collect some material for the programme. You can follow me on Twitter at Norman Swan. That's one word. That's what I'm told you do. I'm sure you know better than me. So you can follow me then and follow my journeys and what I'm finding out. I'm Norman Swan, and you've been listening to The Health Report. I'll see you next week.